Welcome back. In the last lecture, we used the Mediterranean as the setting and as the facilitator of contacts and exchanges between goods and peoples. In this lecture, we're going to examine the political and social structures that evolved specifically among the Greeks and the Romans. We're also going to look at the differing ways in which they defined themselves as communities and get a sense at the beginning of our course of how these two societies came into being. Once again, the Mediterranean itself is a major player in our story, since proximity to the sea and dependency upon it is a catalyst for social and political development. A basic distinction that I shall be drawing is that whereas the most politically advanced Greek communities, Athens in particular, evolved into democracies, Rome evolved into something very different, namely the res publica, the republic, literally the common thing or commonwealth, a form of government which persisted in theory into the period of the emperors. We'll start with Greece. The political entity that was most distinctive of the Greek-speaking world was the polis or city-state, as it is usually translated, from which our word politics is derived. State, however, is problematic as a term. Stateless political community is a recent suggestion of Moshe Berendt. The polis probably came into being sometime in the 8th century BC. In physical terms, it consisted of an urban centre and surrounding territory. It wasn't confined to mainland Greece by any means. In fact, one of the earliest polis, that's the plural of polis, is Smyrna, modern Izmir in Turkey, which dates to the 7th century BC. The existence of the polis is already alluded to in Homer, both in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it may be that Homer himself was a native of Smyrna. It's been estimated that there may have been as many as 1,500 separate political communities dotted around the islands and shores of the Mediterranean, along the southern shore of the Black Sea, in eastern Sicily, southern Italy, and further west, on the southern coast of France, on the eastern coast of Spain, that we shouldn't perhaps think of them all as polis. A Mediterranean cultural phenomenon, indeed. Each polis had its own law code, its own army and navy, its own system of government, its own particular set of gods, and so on. These gods were variations, primarily, of the 12 basic Olympian gods, but they were also particular to a specific polis. The polis system was not only the most distinctive, but also the most developed system of communal living in the Greek world from 750 BC onwards. As Aristotle famously remarked, man is a zoon politikon, a political animal, meaning man is an animal that is designed to live in a polis. That's a rather interesting observation given the fact that he spent a number of years, not in a polis, but at the court of Philip II of Macedon, tutoring Alexander the Great. Indeed, the polis system was very far from being the only system. There were also many Greeks, such as the Aetolians, Thessalians, Macedonians, who were organized much more loosely into tribes or ethne, the plural of ethnos, from which our word ethnic derives. We know very little about the ethne compared with the polis, because they have left no literature and, on the whole, far fewer artifacts. The polis system was remarkably resilient, remarkably flexible, and remarkably durable. It continued to flourish long after the Greeks had lost their independence to Rome. Athens, for one, was still a functioning polis in the Roman imperial period, even though its institutions became subject to Roman scrutiny. So I'll start by talking about Athens, because until the rise of Macedon in the middle of the 4th century BC, Athens, along with Sparta and later Thebes, was the most important polis in the classical period, 480 to 323. It was in Athens that a system of government which we call radical or participatory democracy first evolved. The system was introduced in 462-1, although its origins go back at least as far as 510 BC, when the Athenians expelled a tyrant called Hippias. Or they go back even earlier, to the period of Solon at the beginning of the 6th century, when the demos, the people, from which our word democracy derives, first acquired basic rights. It's important to understand that radical democracy along the Athenian model was worlds removed from our system of representative democracy. Whereas we elect politicians to represent our political views, the Athenians, all adult male citizens that is, had the right and to some extent the obligation to attend the popular assembly and to participate directly in all aspects of the political process. And they also had the right to serve as jurors. Women did not enjoy these rights, of course. I say of course because women did not receive the franchise, the right to vote, anywhere in the West until the 20th century. So any Athenian citizen would have the right to propose a change in the law, propose a peace treaty, propose to go to war, and so on. And there were no career politicians because no one received payment for holding political office, and there were no political parties. In the classical period, however, the assembly was still dominated by a handful of powerful individuals, most of whom were aristocrats. Pericles, for instance, who was the most famous of them all and the dominant figure in Athenian politics from about 445 till his death in 429, was a member of the Alcmeonid genos, or noble kin group. There were elections for political office, but these, for the most part, were decided by lot, the principle being that every Athenian citizen was deemed equal in fitness and ability. The fact of the matter, however, was that those elected to political office wielded very little power, the one exception being the office of general. That's where merit was judged to be all important, and that was why, therefore, a popular vote was cast. Athenian democracy, which under Athenian direction spread to many other cities, was a truly extraordinary phenomenon. We tend to regard it as the spiritual ancestor of our Western democracy. But as I've already indicated, it was both more and less representative than any democratic system that exists in the modern world. In fact, there's no line of descent from antiquity to the present day, which means that we should not call democracy Greece, the cradle of democracy, as one occasionally hears. For more than 1,000 years, democracy completely died out, not only in Greece, but throughout Europe. The roots of our modern democracy have much more to do with feudalism and the medieval republics which preceded them than they do with 5th century Athens. Partly why we look up to Athenian democracy is because of its cultural legacy. Writers such as Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, and the great buildings on the Acropolis like the Parthenon. But wait, can we call these products of Athenian democracy? Who actually paid for them? And who actually built them? The uncomfortable truth is that the buildings on the Acropolis were subsidized by the tribute that Athens extracted from her so-called allies. From 478 BC onwards, Athens was the leader of a maritime alliance whose purpose was to afford protection against the Persians. In time, however, the alliance became a tool of Athenian imperialism. Athens' allies paid heavily for the privilege of being protected. True, Athens kept her side of the bargain by manning a fleet to keep the Persians at bay, but she also profited from her allies by overcharging them, so to speak, and these profits covered the cost of the building program. As for the people who actually did all the building work, well, mostly they were slaves, although the sculpture was executed by master craftsmen, that is, by citizens. It's ironic that slavery became much more prevalent in the Greek world as a result of the impulse towards greater democracy from the late 6th century BC onwards. In fact, democracy could not have taken root in the Greek world without an abundance of slaves to work the land, because by working the land, they freed, in quotes, their masters to participate in the running of the country and fulfill the obligations of citizenship. It's estimated that in the 5th and 4th centuries BC, perhaps as much as 1/3 of the population were slaves in the more politically advanced parts of the Greek-speaking world. So why did the Greeks, some Greeks that is, implement a restrictive kind of democracy? Isn't that at least something that they should take credit for? Well, up to a point. But the fact, too, is that Greek democracy is a function of specific material coordinates. There were two which chiefly favoured it. First, a military system that was founded on, firstly, the hoplite phalanx, a rectangle composed of citizen soldiers in hoplite or heavy armour who fought in rank alongside one another, all equal. And also on the trireme or three-banker warship powered by citizen rowers who rowed all alongside one another equally. And this helped to protect and boost a profitable export economy, by the way, control of the seas. Secondly, two of Athens's chief exports were olive oil and wine. And because olives and grapes are not labor-intensive to grow, farmers had a great deal of spare time. And having a great deal of spare time, they could exercise their civic rights and duties. The other Greek polis I want to give attention to is Sparta, although it's even questionable as to whether Sparta was a polis in the strict sense of the term. That's because it didn't have an urban center comparable to Athens, and because the five centers that it comprised retained some autonomy. In a characteristically shrewd observation, the historian Thucydides writes, "If Sparta were deserted and only the shrines and foundations preserved, hardly anyone would believe that its power matched its reputation, since the city is not unified and does not possess costly shrines and public buildings, but consists of villages in the old-style Greek way. Whereas, if Athens were to suffer the same fate, people would believe it had double the power from its appearance alone." And interestingly, modern archaeology has completely confirmed Thucydides' view, with what Paul Cartledge has noted, lamentable completeness. Though Spartans had some political rights through the popular assembly, it was the kings, Sparta had two kings, and the gerousia, or council of elders, who exercised the real power. Sparta became important by conquering the territory that lay to the west, known as Messenia, and enslaving its population, whom it referred to as Helotai, or Helots. In the 7th century BC, Sparta managed to produce two outstanding poets, Tityus and Alcman, testifying to her cultural sophistication. But sometime in the 6th century, Sparta seems to have taken a decision to become a militaristic society, and she devoted herself to becoming the most efficient military machine the Greek world had ever known. And by 500 BC, she had built up a network of alliances that we call the Peloponnesian League, which modern scholars describe as a hegemonic symmachy, in that Sparta was effectively the hegemon or leader. In 431 BC, Athens and her allies went to war against Sparta and her allies in what's called the Peloponnesian War, because Sparta, a land power, controlled most of the Peloponnese at the time, whereas Athens, a naval power, controlled the eastern Mediterranean. Athens's naval might was, as I just mentioned, based on her fleet of triremes. Trireme means three-banker because it consisted of three decks with three banks of oars. The crew consisted of 170 rowers, 30 officers, and marines. Triremes were the racehorses of the sea lanes. They could attain speeds of about 7 to 8 knots, and were extremely manoeuvrable. When the Peloponnesian War broke out, the Athenians retreated behind their walls, confident in the knowledge that the Spartans would never be able to starve them into submission so long as they retained mastery of the sea. However, things did not go completely as planned. While the Spartans devastated the Attic countryside, the Athenians suffered from a devastating plague as a result of overcrowding in the city. The war dragged on for a quarter of a century with a breather that lasted about 6 years. And it eventually ended in 404 with the defeat of Athens and the dismantling of her empire. To preserve the balance of power, however, Sparta did not destroy Athens as her allies fervently desired, though she did dismantle her walls and deprive her of all but 12 of her triremes. The 4th century BC that followed saw a prolonged period of infighting in the Greek world, during which first Sparta, then Thebes, were the dominant powers. But eventually, a new power thrust itself forward, Macedonia, which rose to prominence on the accession of Philip II in 356 BC. Greek resistance to Philip's advance was lackluster in the extreme, and when the cause was all but lost, the Greeks did manage to form themselves into a coalition led by Athens. But at Chaeronea in Boeotia in 338 BC, that coalition was defeated, and the cities of mainland Greece would never be free again, being destined to be ruled first by Macedon and later by Rome. Philip II was murdered in 336 BC on the eve of leading an expedition against Persia. And it was his son, Alexander the Great, who led the expedition in his place. When he died in Babylon at the age of 36, Alexander had conquered a vast empire that extended from Macedon to the Punjab, taking in Afghanistan along the way. On his death, however, the empire shattered into three large blocks, which formed themselves into monarchies. And this was the world of the Hellenistic monarchies that Rome encountered. So now we'll turn to the Romans. Rome in the first centuries of its existence somewhat resembled a Greek city-state. Like many Greek city-states in the 8th and 7th centuries BC, it was governed by a monarchy. But there were important differences in the Roman concept of kingship, and this tells us a great deal about differences in the two cultures. Greek kings claimed divine descent and a hereditary title. Roman kings were chosen on their own merits. The difference may be due to the fact that Roman origin was a much more heterogeneous community and one that behaved with much more openness to strangers. And that, of course, was itself destined to have profound effects down the ages, not least in terms of the kind of community that Rome became. Why she developed this way is something of a mystery, though it probably has something to do with the fact that in order to survive in the early days, she had to make accommodation with her neighbours. The Romans expelled their last king, Tarquinius Superbus, Tarquin the Proud, in 510 BC, and established what they called a republic, the Res Publica, the Commonwealth. The republic was probably a homegrown product, although in the early period, in its mixture of monarchical, aristocratic, and democratic elements, it somewhat resembled Sparta. It utilized an intricate system of checks and balances intended to restrict the amount of power that any single individual could wield. In practice, however, it functioned as a veiled aristocracy. The Republic consisted of three elements. First, elected magistrates, typically wealthy men of aristocratic birth, who held office for only 1 year. The two magistrates at the very top of the ladder, the consuls, had the power to veto each other's proposals. You couldn't expect to be elected to high office in Rome unless you had funds available to spend on electioneering. Second, the popular assemblies. There were several different kinds of assemblies, each of which was summoned for a particular set of purposes. But although the assemblies comprised, in theory, the entire citizen body, the voting units were divided up in such a way that wealthy aristocrats wielded considerably more influence than the common people. For instance, when the assembly, the Comitia Centuriata, voted, the franchise was not divided into 197 centuries equally, but according to property qualification. And there were very many more centuries for the wealthy than there were devoted for the poor. Third, the Senate. The Senate was composed of ex-magistrates mainly, therefore of wealthy aristocrats. Its role was chiefly advisory, though in the late 2nd century BC, it claimed the right to take charge in a crisis. Hardly surprisingly, in light of all this, the Romans were deeply suspicious of democracy, and they remained throughout their history ideologically committed to the belief that birth and wealth helped define a man's suitability for political and military office. The common man, whom they referred to collectively as the plebs, was not someone in whom they invested any confidence. Roman society was deeply elitist. And as the Romans tended to export their government preferences abroad, they obviously favoured aristocratic governments in their provinces, since aristocrats had both more to lose from resisting Roman rule and more to gain from complying with Roman rule. It was a system that lent itself at times to bribery and corruption. Well, the Republic had a good run for its money. As Rome expanded, it eventually began to crack under the strain, but not before the final decades of the 2nd century BC. Octavian, later the Emperor Augustus, made much of this fact by claiming that he restored, in inverted commas, the Republic in 27 BC. He did so, but henceforth it was subject to the dictates of the Emperor. So far, we've focused on the political systems. I'd now like to look at how the Greeks and Romans defined themselves as a community. Community for both cultures was based on the notion of citizenship. For both the Greeks and the Romans, a citizen was an adult male whose father was himself a citizen. Everyone else was excluded, including women, minors, foreigners, and slaves. They'll be the subject of a later lecture. Community, therefore, means only those who were regarded as fully paid-up members of society, those who possessed political and legal rights, adult males. In Athens, for instance, this meant the demos, or people. By their own definition, the Romans were the senatus populusque Romanus, the Senate and the people of Rome. Incidentally, you still find the letters SPQR inscribed on the manhole covers within the municipality of Rome to this day, courtesy of the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini, who sought, in this way and others, to revive Rome's imperial grandeur. However, citizenship in the case of the Romans didn't just mean the people who actually lived in Rome. From the 1st century BC onwards, as a result of what we call the social war, the war that the Allies or Socii fought against Rome, citizenship had been extended to everyone living in Italy. That meant that many people had the right to call themselves Roman who had never actually set foot in Rome. And from then on, the number of people who claimed Roman citizenship continued to grow in line with Rome's growing needs. The Romans awarded grants of citizenship, for instance, to doctors to encourage them to practice in the Roman world. So too, legionaries who had served in the Roman army were awarded citizenship upon discharge. And increasingly, over the course of time, the majority of those living within the borders of the Roman Empire could call themselves Roman, until AD 212, when the Emperor Caracalla passed an edict declaring officially that freeborn males living inside the Roman Empire were all classified as citizens. Even at this point, however, the Roman Empire hardly comprised a single coherent community. Rather, it was a melting pot, to use the current jargon, comprising many disparate peoples who spoke many tongues, who followed different customs and traditions, worshipped different gods, and who felt in varying degrees and ways either connected to or disconnected from Rome. The Greeks, of course, were just one of these people, though arguably the most privileged of all the peoples subject to the Romans, because of their usefulness. The only thing that all these peoples, without exception and unequivocally shared in common from 27 BC onwards, was the requirement to acknowledge the authority of the Roman emperor and of the power he symbolized. By any standards that prevail in the West today, both the Greeks and the Romans took a very conservative view of community. One point that was common to both, and one that is very central to this topic, is that both societies put a premium on aristocratic birth. And this is reflected in the terminology relating to social status. In the case of the Greeks, the term for an aristocrat was kalos kagathos, which literally means one who is handsome and good. And conversely, a member of the lower social order was termed kakos, which means bad. Bad also in the moral sense of the word. And this kind of value judgment must have profoundly influenced relations between the social orders. And even though the drive towards democracy in many Greek societies introduced egalitarianism in the political and legal arenas, respect for birth and privilege remained an entrenched feature of Greek society. For their part, the Romans divided the citizen body into the plebs, the undifferentiated mass of citizenry, and the patricians, a term connected with patres, meaning fathers, a term also used of the senators. In short, class prejudice was a fixed feature of both societies, though it's fair to say that the opportunities for upward social mobility were much greater in the Roman world than they were in the Greek. A striking early instance of upward mobility in Roman society is recorded in the case of the sixth king of Rome, Servius Tullius, to whom the Romans ascribed a slave ancestry based on the fact that they derived Servius from servus, meaning slave. True or not, the theory articulated the belief that it was possible in Roman society, even in the period of the monarchy, to rise to the highest position in the land. The most spectacular example of upward social mobility is that of Theodora, who was the daughter of a bear keeper and who became the wife and trusted confidant of the Byzantine Emperor Justinian in the first half of the 6th century AD. In both societies, the family was a tightly knit structure upon which the sense of community was based. For the Greeks, as for the Romans, the family was a religious unit. The head of the family, therefore, had a priestly function in charge of a variety of cults that focused upon the welfare of the family. In Rome, from earliest times, the head of the nuclear family, known as the pater familias, also had the right of life or death over his children, sons and daughters alike. We don't actually know of any pater familias who exercised this power, but the fact that he had it says much about the reverence in which fathers were expected to be held by their children. And that also tells us much about the difference between the two societies. A further distinction is that the Romans, unlike the Greeks, had a highly developed patron-client system. At all levels of the food chain, so to speak, individuals were in some sense beholden to those more powerful and more wealthy than themselves, who in turn were expected to dispense favours. These favours could take a variety of forms, including jobs, contracts, various kinds of handouts, invitations to dinner parties, etc. And on the part of the clients, it involved voting for one's patron's choice of candidate in every election, which is another reason why Roman elections were anything but democratic. To conclude, both the Greek world and the Roman world demonstrate many features in common, both socially and politically speaking. In both, we find evidence of democratic tendencies, and in both, a predisposition to favour the aristocracy. Community, however, was more broadly defined in the case of the Romans than it was in the case of the Greeks, since consciously, deliberately, or otherwise, the Romans came to accept the principle of universalism that was alien to the Greeks. It was therefore under the Romans that there truly evolved a more or less uniform Mediterranean culture. And perhaps the most important influence in the creation of a uniform Mediterranean culture was law. So, in the next lecture, we're going to look at how legislation and legal process evolved.